Happy St. Patrick's Day. It's your takeaway for Friday, March 17th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I am Sarah Gonzalez filling in for John Hockenberry today. Thanks so much for listening and happy St. Patrick's Day. We begin this hour with an agency that is facing a very different future than it did just a year ago. On Thursday, President Trump sent a budget to Congress that included cutting nearly a third of funding to the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. The 31% cut would scrap key environmental regulations introduced by President Barack Obama, including his signature Clean Power Plan. It's also proposed cuts to climate change research and international climate change programs.
Regarding the question as to climate change, I think the president was fairly straightforward. Is that we're not spending money on that anymore. We consider that to be a waste of your money.
That is Mick Mulvaney speaking yesterday. He's the director of the Office of Management and Budget. President Trump has tapped one of the agency's toughest critics to be its leader, former Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt. Speaking last week on CNBC's Squawk Box, Pruitt said he would not agree that carbon dioxide is a primary contributor to global warming.
No, I think that measuring with precision human activity on the climate is something very challenging to do, and there's tremendous disagreement about the degree of impact. So no, I would not agree that it's a primary contributor to the global warming that we see.
The new administrator clearly has very different beliefs about climate change and different plans for the EPA than his predecessor, Gina McCarthy. She served as administrator from 2013 until this year, and she joins me now from our partner station, WGBH in Boston. Gina McCarthy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Sarah. It's great to be here.
So a proposed $2.6 billion cut to the EPA, that would mean more than 3,000 jobs go away. Administrator McCarthy, as the former head of the agency, what would a cut like that mean for the EPA?
Well, I have to tell you that this budget is literally and figuratively a scorched earth budget. It really represents an all-out assault on clean air, water, and land. You just can't put America first when you put the health of its people and its country last. And that's what this budget really represents. It's really about taking away our ability and the state's ability to do the very work that we've been doing for 47 years that has protected people's public health by bringing them clean water and air.
President Trump's budget specifically targets the Clean Power Plan. What is at stake there?
The most important thing, I think, for the public to understand is that that was a well-done rule that is in the courts. That's where it belongs. We're waiting for the court to take action. Even if, you know, Trump issues an executive order, he can't make the rule go away. The rule continues until another rule takes its place, and hopefully saner heads will prevail. People will realize that this is good for us. This is the way the clean energy transition is working. And it's tremendously important, not just for our public health and our national security, but it's an incredibly important recognition in terms of where jobs are growing, where the economy is heading.
The budget also would cut funding for climate research and international climate change programs like the Paris Climate Agreement. How would that impact people in the United States and around the world?
Well, thankfully, over the past 8 years under President Obama, we've been able to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions more than any other developed nation. So we're on a track towards clean energy. But what it doesn't do is send a strong commitment that every country needs to continue to stay together, because we know that we need more solutions on the table. That in the end, if you want to achieve the kind of reductions that science tells us are necessary, we need to do more. We need new innovation and new tools. We're quite certain they'll come about, but only if you send that long-term signal. So at best, it's going to be, you know, 4 years of losing ground on something that the world can't afford to lose ground on. And at worst, it's the United States is going to look not just give up a leadership position, but we're going to look like we don't understand the kind of data and science that the rest of the world acknowledges. And it's very sad, because EPA and the science in the United States are the gold standard for the world. You know, everybody else in the world wants to be like us in terms of having the public health protections, the clean air, and the strong economy. you know, why we'd want to deny that at this point is certainly well beyond me. But when you cut our Superfund program, which is our hazardous waste program, by 30%, when you wipe out our geographic programs like the work in Chesapeake Bay and the Great Lakes, that's significant. When you take 45% of the state funds and you decide not to give them to the states anymore to implement the programs that have brought clean air and clean water, it really puts public health at significant risk, and it turns the clock back 40 years.
Many in the Republican Party doubt the science of climate change and the role of the EPA. Here is Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma speaking yesterday on CNN.
But we're going to take the all this stuff that comes out of the EPA that's brainwashing our kids, that is propaganda, things that aren't true.
What is your reaction to that?
It's pretty shocking language, and you know, it's really hard to believe that they're on an all-attack mode of an agency whose sole mission it is to protect human health and the environment. You know, an agency that's done nothing other than what benefits, you know, our children and future generations. You know, we've reduced air pollution 70% while the GDP has tripled. What's the danger here? You know, the real danger on climate is that people like Senator Inhofe have come to make it some type of a religious belief. And instead of being a religion, it is simple fact. It is simple science. It's evidence telling us that we are facing a significant challenge that deserves everybody working together to address it. And, you know, the risks here and what's at stake is tremendous. It's no less than the viability of the planet to continue to have us be part of that planet. Sarah, if you look at it, I know they talk about the agency has overreached, but if you look at the rules we've done under the Clean Air Act to address climate change, if you look at the past 3 years, we have a complete wins in 90% of those cases, and the others have been minor tweaks back. So we are not overreaching. Ask the courts. Let them do their job. Let us do our job and do what Congress said. That's what the American people want. It's been saying that in a bipartisan way for 47 years, because I don't know any Republican that doesn't want to bring good, clean air to their kids and good, clean water.
Well, President Trump met with top auto executives earlier this week. Their concern is that regulations imposed under the Obama administration are making it difficult for the United States to compete in the global economy. What is your response to that?
Well, when President Obama came into office, if you remember, he bailed out the auto industry because of the millions of jobs that they represented. And one of the things that came out of it was a good, sound discussion on what are our automakers actually producing for vehicles and why are we falling so far behind in terms of giving consumers energy-efficient vehicles that will make it less expensive for them to drive their cars, but also make them cleaner and reduce the greenhouse gases. And so we've passed rules, we've finalized them with great public input and with the support of the automakers that actually are moving energy efficiency, nearly doubling it by 2025 in their cars that people want to buy. You know how I know? Not because I'm projecting it, because people are buying them. You know, these are the cars that people are now wanting to buy and in moving towards electric vehicles, which are going to be an astounding change.
I want to ask you quickly about President Trump's proposal to extend the border wall between the United States and Mexico. What impact does a wall or a fence like that have on the environment or on wildlife? I'm from the San Diego-Tijuana-Mexico border, so I grew up right next to that border. I saw it extend into the Pacific Ocean. What kind of an environmental impact does that have?
I think we know that the way in which wildlife work is dictated by nature, not by a wall. And there has always been significant concern about whether you're cutting up ecosystems. But I think one of the most important things, at least for EPA and for me, is pollution knows no boundaries either. Mm-hmm. And so we have been working with Mexico and working with Canada and many other countries. Right now, we're talking about how to make our energy system move more readily across those boundaries so that we can make sure that we can share renewable resources.
Well, and part of the White House outlines cuts to funding that goes to Mexico from the EPA as well.
There's very little that hasn't been cut. We're talking about 50 programs going away. Half of our scientists are supposed to leave this coming year. So, I mean, we're talking really about devastating the agency and what it does and diminishing our leverage and our ability as not just as scientists but innovators, as technology developers, to work with other countries to meet their needs in a way that's going to continue to create jobs and to reap the economic rewards of that innovation. We may want to think that the environment is somehow at odds with the economy. But frankly, I don't know why we would want to live in the United States of America if we wanted to degrade our drinking water, if we wanted to allow, you know, all of the land to be taken up with industrial use without controls on that pollution. It just is envisioning a future that we rejected 45 years ago. Just look back. Los Angeles, you couldn't see across the street. My beloved Boston Harbor, that is now the engine of the city of Boston, was so polluted you wanted to make sure that you didn't put your toe in it. You know, these are things that we just simply have to reject going back to. And I don't know how you do that if you have no cop on the beat, no rules of the road, businesses competing with unlevel playing fields. That's just not the United States. Let's just cut this out. Let's talk real, and let's talk about protecting the people that we have been obligated to serve.
Gina McCarthy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sarah. It was great to be here.
Gina McCarthy served as EPA Administrator under President Obama. We're at the tail end of what has been a very busy week for the Trump administration, and we want to bring you up to speed quickly on another important development out of Washington.
So now you have to decide, are you going to take the tweets literally? And if you are, then clearly the president was wrong.
President Trump has to provide the American people with evidence.
It's all rather shocking to me that a sitting president would make this kind of an allegation about a former president without any proof whatsoever.
I think if we don't get it today, the Congress is going to ramp up the pressure.
I have no reason to believe that the charge is true. The President of the United States could clear this up in a minute.
Leaders of the Senate Intelligence Committee said in a joint statement on Thursday that there was no evidence to support President Trump's claims that Trump Tower was wiretapped by President Obama. The White House has been unable to confirm that conclusion.
There's been a vast amount of reporting, which I just detailed, about activity that was going on in the 2016 election. There's no question that there were surveillance techniques used throughout this. I think by a variety of outlets that have reported this activity concluded. So, and I think when you actually ask those two people whether or not, and as Chairman Nunes says yesterday, when you take it literally in wiretapping, the president's already been very clear that he didn't mean specifically wiretapping. He had it in quotes. So I think to fall back on that is a false premise.
That's White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer briefing reporters on Thursday. Meanwhile, several lawmakers in Britain are angry that the Trump administration suggested, with no proof, that London spy agencies aided Obama in conducting the surveillance. We'll be continuing to follow that story as it develops. But coming up next, Sebastian Gorka's role in the White House explained. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, filling in for John Hockenberry. Stay with us. You're listening to The Takeaway. John Hockenberry's out today. I'm Sarah Gonzalez. And if you haven't heard of Sebastian Gorka before this week, well, you might know his name by now. Sebastian Gorka is a deputy assistant to President Trump, and he also reports to Steve Bannon as part of the White House's Strategic Initiatives Group inside the National Security Council. It's one of many appointments by the Trump administration met with skepticism from establishment Washington figures. Gorka is known for his staunch views on counterterrorism. For instance, he advocates that terrorism is inherently rooted in Islam. Here he is in a June 2016 interview with Sean Hannity.
Get politics out of the threat assessment. No more censorship, none of this gobbledygook narrative that it's not about jihad and it's not about religion. Jettison that.
And here he is in December after Trump was elected.
You know, the message I have, it's a very simple one. It's a bumper sticker, Sean. The era of the pajama boy is over January 20th, and the alpha males are back.
Now, on Thursday, it was revealed that Gorka has ties to a Hungarian far-right group with Nazi affiliations. When he was asked about the accusations yesterday, Gorka initially refused to respond. Then, later, he denied his membership in the organization. Greg Jaffe, staff reporter for The Washington Post, has traced Gorka's career from the fringe to the center of power.
What makes him so controversial is that for years, and this goes from the Bush administration through the Obama administration, the general consensus has been that the radicalization process is a really complicated thing. You know, it has everything to do with repression, poverty, you know, governments that torture their citizens, and to a certain extent, the use of religious text. I think what makes Gorka different is that he said all that other stuff doesn't matter. So poverty doesn't matter, poor governance doesn't matter, history, torture, culture. You know, what matters is religion. And essentially, the terrorist motivations are rooted in these ancient texts of the Quran.
And how did he become a expert on terrorism before he arrived at the White House?
You know, he's largely self-taught, so that's what's interesting. You know, most of the big counterterrorism experts hadn't really heard of him before. He gets his PhD at a relatively obscure university in Hungary and teaches at a DOD school, a Defense Department school, that teaches largely foreign students, and it's non-accredited when he starts there. And, you know, it's largely through his own readings of Islam that he comes to his conclusions.
And how did he make the leap from the fringe to the White House?
You know, it's interesting. When he's at that school, he's a very popular and dynamic lecturer. Some of his fellow professors worry that his ideas seem extreme to them. They seem kind of too narrowly focused on Islam and not taking into account other things. So they push him to publish in peer-reviewed journals, which he pushes back on, either because he doesn't want to do or because he doesn't like having his ideas challenged in that way. And so what happens is he leaves the school and goes to a place called Marine Corps University, which is another DOD-funded school, but he's not an employee of the university. And once he's there, he's no longer a government employee. He's allowed to speak out a lot more, becomes a star on Fox News, catches the attention of Steve Bannon, who's mm-hmm. running Breitbart at that time, and Bannon hires him as sort of the national security editor at Breitbart.
So what is Gorka's current role in the White House now?
You know, he works for something called the Strategic Initiatives Group, which is a sort of in-house think tank that reports to Steve Bannon. And what exactly they do and what their role is, it's hard to know. Some folks describe them as essentially just that, sort of an inside ideas factory for Bannon. Some folks describe them as sort of a shadow National Security Council making policy. What we do know is that Gorka played a pretty central role in the drafting of the first executive order on refugees and immigration. Beyond that, you know, he's defended it on television a lot. I know the president, you know, likes the way he talks on TV. He likes the sort of combative nature that Sebastian brings to television hits. And so he likes him out there defending the administration.
And so his ideas about Islam, which we now see driving the Trump administration's approach to counterterrorism and national security. But does Gorka actually wield as much power as he maybe claims? He's on the National Security Council, but there's some dispute over whether he has a security clearance.
He's, as far as I understand, he's not on the National Security Council. Now, Steve Bannon is his boss, but he's not. And so he's a member of the White House rather than the NSC. As to his security clearance, I think that's a little murky, as my last understanding was that he did have a security clearance or that it had come through after some delay. And I guess it's not unexpected that there should be some delay, in part because he's a tri-citizen, a U.S., a Hungarian, and a British citizen, and that may have caused some problems, but we just don't know.
And let's talk about the accusations that Gorka has ties to a Nazi allied group in Hungary. That came out in The Forward yesterday. I understand that you knew about this in February. What do we know now, and why didn't you report on it at the time?
You know, I have mixed feelings about it. We did know that he was in that group back in February, or at least affiliated with it, because he comes to the inauguration, you know, in a very dramatic fashion. One of the inaugural balls, he's wearing this sort of high-necked, formal Hungarian uniform kind of thing. He's got a DOD civilian service medal that he's pinned to it, and this Hungarian crest of arms that is affiliated with this group. You know, it's tough. I mean, the group, as I understand it, and I'm by no means an expert in it, has a complicated history. They welcome in the Nazis to Hungary, certainly, but then there's some suggestion that they, as the Nazis turn on the Jews, that they try and protect Hungarian Jews. After World War II, they become a staunch anti-communist group. And Gorka's dad is somebody who battles against the communists and is actually, as Gorka describes it in his book about counterterrorism, a spy for the Brits. He's feeding them information and is caught by the communists, locked in prison, and then escapes to the UK where he becomes a refugee. And so for Gorka, my sense is that this crest that he was wearing is really more a tribute to his dad than anything else. And so I just worry that it's a complicated story. And for me, sometimes it has echoes of people on the left who tried to sort of smear Barack Obama and others with his affiliations or his brief encounters with Saul Alinsky. I'm just not quite sure what to make of it.
Greg Jaffe, reporter for The Washington Post, thanks so much for joining me.
Sure, no problem. Thanks for having me.
What a difference a year makes.
I think Merkel in Germany, she's done an amazing job. I think she's been, she's really the leader. And as a woman, she's done a fantastic job in Germany, keeping it all together. Their economy is going great. They're doing very well, you know.
That was then-candidate Donald Trump speaking about German Chancellor Angela Merkel in an interview he did with the Chicago Tribune editorial board back in June 2015. The following June, he was singing a different tune.
And now you look at what's happening in Germany. So I used to be a fan of Merkel. I used to think she was terrific, a big leader, a great leader. I think what she did to Germany is a disgrace, is a disgrace. It's a total disgrace.
Today, German Chancellor Angela Merkel travels to the White House, where she and President Trump will meet face-to-face for the first time since the election. It's also for the first time before her election in Germany, where she is seeking a fourth term.
The coming election will be difficult. We will probably be criticized from everywhere, from the right-wing parties, and also because of the polarization of our society.
Merkel is known for being able to put personal animosities aside and persuasively negotiate with some pretty tough world leaders. Vladimir Putin in Russia, Silvio Berlusconi in Italy. Some have even described her as the last defender of the liberal free world. And those skills will likely be put to the test with a lot riding on today's bilateral meeting. Constanza Stelzenmüller is Robert Bosch Senior Fellow with the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. She joined me today before the meeting.
This White House and President Trump himself have made it sound in their foreign policy statements as though America really doesn't need allies to accomplish its purposes worldwide, whether in trade or in security issues. And I think the chancellor will want to make the point on behalf of Germany and all of Europe that actually that's not true.
And Trump has labeled Germany as an unfair trading partner. He has threatened to impose a 35% tariff on German car makers. And Merkel is bringing the CEO of BMW with her to, I guess, help discourage Trump from going in that direction?
Yep. I think that is pretty much the idea. She's also bringing people who will talk about German jobs training, which is considered a very successful model of training young people on the job, as accounted for a very low German youth unemployment. And I think it's thought by the Merkel's team that that is something that could help President Trump in his goal of making America and particularly the American economy great again. As for the trade deficit with America, I think that Chancellor Merkel is going to point out that there is a great deal of direct investment by German companies in America and the other way around. A lot of American companies working in Germany, and that so these kinds of punitive taxes would actually damage American companies.
Interesting. Yeah, and an article in Politico about their visit says that German industry has invested hundreds of billions of dollars in U.S. production or U.S.-based production, and that German companies employ almost 700,000 Americans. Let's talk a little bit about Russia. Merkel knows Putin pretty well. They talk often, and she really led Europe in pushing for sanctions against Russia. Do you think that they'll talk about Putin?
Well, the White House has in fact told reporters that that is one of the things that President Trump wants to talk about with the chancellor and her team. He at some point will have to meet with Putin himself, and the chancellor is probably the world leader with the greatest experience because of her growing up in East Germany. She speaks fluent Russian, has met with Putin a lot, often, as you say, but also I think has generally taken a dim view of the Kremlin's revisionism in Eastern Europe, the annexation of Crimea, and its continued meddling not just in Eastern Ukraine, but in Europe through political propaganda. And I'm certain that that's a point that she will want to dwell on.
And Trump has really criticized Merkel's handling of the refugee crisis. He said that she was ruining the country for accepting refugees. And I want you to talk to me a little bit more about her reputation for being able to put aside personal attacks like this in the interest of her country. Do you anticipate any in-person friction?
Well, let me make a point about the refugees first. On the refugees, it was kind of a damned if you do and damned if you don't situation. People were, you know, literally flowing to Europe in the summer of 2015. And if Germany had not let them in, the country that was most prosperous in Europe, the country that was most able to deal with this influx, there would have been a huge impact all the way down to the Balkans on countries much more vulnerable than Germany. It's certainly true that Germany struggled for a while with processing this huge influx. It particularly struggled with sending back those who couldn't stay. I think by now, most of these people have been processed. The ones who are staying, I think, have been distributed across the country, are learning German, are being integrated. A lot of effort is being made there. And at the same time, I think there is a significant uptick in German government efforts to send back those who can't stay or prosecute those who have exhibited some kind of malignant intent or even pursued terrorist goals. I think Chancellor Merkel is perfectly capable of rising above a difficult relationship. She wouldn't have been chancellor for 12 years if she wasn't able to do that. And there have been a variety of difficult, mostly male partners she's had to deal with, from Italy's Silvio Berlusconi to Russia's Vladimir Putin. So I'm quite confident that she can handle today.
Constanza Selzenmuller is Robert Bosch Senior Fellow with the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. Constanza, thank you so much.
And thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a pleasure.
Hello, IT. Have you tried turning it off and on again?
What is a weekend?
And are all your dresses pink?
I do have another, in O'Donnell.
Wibbly wobbly, timey-wimey stuff.
Takeaway culture reporter Melissa Locker has been a longtime fan of shows like Downton Abbey and Doctor Who. And thanks to streaming services like Hulu, Netflix, and Amazon Prime, American audiences now have access to even more British programming, including dark thrillers like Black Mirror and cult favorites like Peep Show. But where to start? And what's worth spending time on, even if a series contains just 5 or 6 episodes? Melissa's here with the list to help us sift through the pile.
So one of the shows that has been around for a while is on Netflix. It's called Peaky Blinders, and it's about a gang in 1919 Birmingham, and they have this very sort of classic crime charm.
You pay the Peaky Blinders a lot of money for protection. You're the law around here now, Tommy, aren't you? Maybe you should put a bullet in Danny Whizbang's head like they do with mad horses. Maybe you'll have to put a bullet in my head someday, too.
It was sort of meant to be the British version of Boardwalk Empire, and it's not quite as good as Boardwalk Empire, but it's still pretty darn good. And I believe there's like 3 or 4 seasons out now, so you can definitely binge watch. However, if you like a little more guts and glory, you should definitely consider watching a new show that's on FX right now. It's called Taboo. Tom Hardy plays a guy who went off to Africa and kind of earned his fortune there, and everyone in his family thought he was dead, but then he shows up at his father's funeral and prepares to take over his father's shipping business. And he wants it to become this huge rivalry with like the Dutch East Indies Company or something in comparison to that.
You've been following me, haven't you? Now, are you king or are you company? It doesn't matter.
You should be aware, it's slightly ridiculous. It's very melodramatic, but it's really, really fun to watch and totally absorbing. If you're looking for a lighter show, Chewing Gum, which is on Netflix, stars Tracy Gordon as a sort of religious Beyoncé-obsessed 20-something who is making her way in the world. It's really funny and engaging.
Okay, World War Nord, I want to break up with you.
Why?
What? You hate me.
So?
I think it's important to not hate the person you're with, okay? I think you should just go and find a girl that you like.
I like you more than I like all the others.
If you enjoy chewing gum, you're probably also going to enjoy Fleabag, which is on Amazon. It also stars kind of a younger, millennial-type person trying to find their way in the world, fighting through love and depression and food. And honestly, in between chewing gum and Fleabag, you're seeing two characters that you don't really see very often on TV. Because typically, kind of bigger mainstream, you know, network television shows just aren't going to feature a kind of quirky, weird 20-something who hangs out in their bedroom all the time. If you are a big fan of Downton Abbey, which, I mean, isn't everybody sort of a fan of Downton Abbey? You're going to want to watch The Crown. The young Queen Elizabeth is working to forge a relationship with Sir Winston Churchill while the British Empire is in decline, and it just has a really, really charming cast. And the second season is coming soon, but I have to tell you, there's some crazy changes happening, and you may not like them. But if you want to know what the drama is, you have to watch the first season, and then you can get very irate when season two comes around. So there's a new show on Hulu called National Treasure. It looks at a British comedian, someone probably in the lines of like Monty Python or, you know, even Bill Cosby, who is accused of some horrible crimes in the very first episode.
Rebecca Thornton alleges that on the 8th of December 1993, you raped her on the film set of Japes in Bedford. Can you remember any details from that night?
No.
Does that face mean anything to you?
Means nothing, sorry. She must have made a mistake.
And his wife doesn't know what to believe. He has no recollection of this happening, but there's a kind of a mystery involved. And it's really hard to tell whether you believe him or you don't believe him. It's very dark. It's kind of slow, but it is very, very addictive. This is Melissa Laca for The Takeaway. I'm going to go have a pint, eat some hobnobs, have some crisps and some chips, and enjoy some British television this weekend.
Melissa Laca is culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway.
I just want to tell you all how happy I am to be back in the studio, making a picture again.
It was a bilious piece of dirt that made me cry out in pain.
Did you say it was a brilliant piece of work and you'll fly me out to Spain?
I've seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it.
It's Friday, so that means we're talking about movies coming out this weekend. And as always, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, is with us. Hi, Rafer.
Hi, Sarah. Nice to be here on your first day hosting.
Oh, well, thank you. All right, let's start with the big one, Beauty and the Beast. Take a listen to this scene from Where Else? The Enchanted Castle.
Now, remember, be gentle.
Kind. Charming.
Sweet.
And when she opens the door, give her a dashing debonair smile. Come, come, show me the smile.
Oh, no.
Okay, so this live-action retelling of the animated Disney fairy tale is out today. And Rafer, I, if you can't tell, am very excited about it. Tell me that I should be.
Are you one of the people that's excited about Emma Watson playing Belle? It's a perfect piece of casting, right? You know, Hermione Granger becomes Belle. It's perfect. And Disney has a good track record of this stuff, I mean, remaking their old classics, Jungle Book, Pete's Dragon, Cinderella. I wish I had better news for you. I found this to be a rather stiff and kind of lifeless telling. Even though it is live action, you'd think it would kind of come to life more. I'll tell you what my big problem is. That scene that you just heard with Lumiere, the candelabra, Cogsworth, the clock, Mrs. Potts, the teapot, all of those figures that you remember from the animated film that were so lively and expressive and buoyant, they're CGI figures here, and they're a little stiff. You can't really read the expressions on their faces that well. Lumiere, who does Be Our Guest, one of the greatest numbers in the original film, he has almost no expression on his face throughout that entire number, and I found that kind of sucked the life out of the movie for me, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, no. Okay, well, what about the Beast? The internet, I remember when the trailers, when we first saw pictures of the new Beast, the internet was very upset about how mean the Beast looked because he has a much kinder face than the animated version.
Right. He's more a figure of fun and some tenderness in the animated version. And he is that here, too. But once again, Dan Stevens, who plays the Beast, he's underneath this, you know, layers of makeup and also CGI effects and things. And I think it just kind of takes away from his ability to kind of express those emotions that you remember so well from the animated original. And, you know, I'd take the 1991 movie any day over this one. I'm sorry.
And I heard it's pretty close to the original movie, but I hear that Belle in this film, I mean, I think she's considered one of the smarter Disney princesses.
Yes.
She's always reading. And in this movie, her dad isn't the inventor. She is the inventor, right?
Well, she does have her moments of inventing. There is a funny moment where she sort of invents the washing machine in a way. I won't spoil it, but it's kind of a cute moment at the beginning. And I know that Emma Watson has said that she tried to, you know, give Belle a little more agency and a little more empowerment in the film. I was looking for that. I didn't really see that many signs of it in the film.
Okay, movie number two, the Belko experiment.
Please, stop putting words in my mouth.
I'm sorry, but that sounds to me like you're saying you want to kill innocent people.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that we need to discuss all our options.
Well, we understand, but we are not going to entertain the option of killing people.
Okay, what is this movie? Is it a horror movie? Is it a satire?
It is. It's a little bit of both. It's about an American company based in Bogota, Colombia, and its workers one day are trapped inside the building and told that they have to kill several of each other. And if they don't, even more will be killed. And so what you have is this kind of cloistered survival of the fittest scenario inside a workplace, which I think is a pretty fun and kind of funny idea for a horror film. I would say what makes this work is the great cast. Michael Rooker from Guardians of the Galaxy, the great John C. McGinley, who plays the office creep who's always like hitting on the women. You can guess where he takes things in this movie. I wish it had been a little more pointed, a little more satirical, as you were saying. But it's fun. It's funny. It's got a great moment where somebody kills somebody else with a scotch tape dispenser. I think that's kind of worth the price of admission right there.
All right. Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday. Rafer, thanks for being here and have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Hey, it's Sarah Gonzalez in for John Hockenberry today, and this is The Takeaway. The national debate over the advantages our society gives to some and not to others is as old as the country itself. But the word privilege feels like it may be experiencing a little bit of a renaissance. If before, privilege was not as openly acknowledged, these days you might be told to check your privilege and acknowledge unearned advantages that exist in your life, whether they're related to your race, your gender, or your wealth. Here's what you are saying about it. One of you from Mount Crawford, Virginia writes, "Privilege is me looking white with a daughter who is biracial. I'm very conscious of how we may be received differently by the same people."
This is John in Oklahoma City. Privilege is a condition of living free in this great republic. I enjoy it each day, along with the personal responsibility it affords me and requires of me.
This is Jack from Council Bluffs, Iowa. Overall, privilege is defined being white, and there are levels of privilege depending upon how much money you have. But even the poorest white person often has more privilege than most other people of color.
Writer Phoebe Maltz-Bovey says all this awareness around the word privilege has some drawbacks. And she's the author of a new book out this month, The Perils of Privilege, Why Injustice Can't Be Solved by Accusing Others of Advantage. And she spoke to John Hockenberry about rethinking how we use the word and when we claim it.
My book, The Perils of Privilege, is not specifically about one form of privilege. It's about the concept of privilege, which could be white privilege, but it could also be male privilege, wealth, any sort of unearned advantage. And in terms of why it's frustrating, I think one of the reasons is that when you're just told you're privileged, you're not necessarily sure why you're being told this, because it can be a vague term. And I think it's immensely easy to talk in certain respects about privilege because people often like to confess theirs. I think it's easier for a privileged person to say that they're privileged than for a not privileged person to explain that situation.
But you say accusing others of advantage doesn't achieve a solution to the problem of injustice. What is an example of where you see the notion of privilege confusing something or just making a problem?
What I'm focused on really is this, in terms of accusation, is conversations that happen among people, all of whom are equivalently privileged. And those conversations, I don't think, help anybody. And I think they're about sort of posturing and being kind of self-righteous and showing that you're the better person and all of that. But in terms of where it can be confusing, I think that privilege, different forms can be kind of mixed up with one another. And I think that the one that comes up a lot is the question of white privilege. If it's used towards somebody who is white but not wealthy, they may hear the word privilege, think that that's referring to wealth, and what they think they're denying is being wealthy. They're not necessarily being willfully oblivious. I think there are people who are being willfully oblivious, but it's sort of case by case.
On the question of white privilege, do whites assume that they're off the hook if they acknowledge that they have privilege or white guilt?
One reason I wrote this book really was that I had seen this phenomenon of white people and also men and also wealthy people, but to just stick with the example of white people, acknowledging their privilege basically as a way of deflecting possible charges of racism. And I guess that's like being performatively woke would be the way that's discussed now. That happens for a variety of reasons. Sometimes I think it's a well-meaning and these days especially very understandable desire to distance oneself from racists. But I think it can also be a way of trying to show that you're one of the good ones. And I think that that's a bit self-serving and not necessarily actually helping anybody. But the privilege approach encourages white people to overshoot the mark and kind of think of people of color almost like a walking representation of all these social issues rather than just as human beings.
You can think and talk and rationalize and say that you're privileged and that you're not racist as much as you want. But if you don't actually move in a world where there are other people and other experiences, you're really not doing much of importance, I guess is what you're saying.
Yeah, and I think that a big part of privilege accusation taking off now has to do with people living their lives a lot online. And I think if you don't even know who you're talking to, it's very easy to put people into sort of assumed categories that are not even really identity categories, but more just sort of as if people are basically sort of walking social issues. And I think that that's not just day-to-day possible when you're interacting mainly in person.
Historians say that, you know, getting away from the language problems and the question of popular culture, that one of the difficulties in American history is that whites have never been able to really articulate how the consequences of history have resulted in an advantage. And so that when we use this kind of American democracy, everybody's equal construct, that looks just so completely false to African Americans because you're not acknowledging, what history says. But it's also true that, in this democracy where we're all supposed to be equal, you know, there's no inducement to actually figure out what the privilege mm-hmm. of being white is. And so that's a real problem in our discourse, it seems.
Right. I mean, I think it's good that people are talking about systemic injustice. What I would urge just when talking about these things in the abstract is to talk about it as injustice and not to talk about the absence of injustice as privilege, because I think what that does is suggests that everyone who has anything should have less rather than that those who have less should have more.
Phoebe Maltz-Bovey is the author of the new book, The Perils of Privilege, and she's the sisterhood editor at The Forward.
Thanks, John. Glad to be here.
This is Mark from Beaverton, Oregon. Privilege is the ability to do or to not do something more easily than others can because of who I am instead of what I've done in the eyes of other people.
My name is Jennifer. I'm calling from Westboro, Massachusetts. I am white, and I have known that I am privileged to be so. My parents' best friends were an interracial couple, and we shared a duplex in the inner city of Boston when we were small. They had a son and daughter the same age as my brother and I, and we all went to nursery school together in our mixed-race neighborhood. I recall always being aware of the subtle differences of how they were treated at school and in the neighborhood compared to my brother and I. Having grown up with black friends has made me especially sensitive to racial inequality in any form, and I am always helping to point it out to others who may not see it.
So what does privilege mean to you? From Charlotte, North Carolina, today, having food, a home, and insurance benefits are the new privilege. I am privileged in that I have all these things. Getting ahead is rarely possible unless you already have money. From Milton, Florida, privilege is money, nothing more than that. Remember, you can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to weigh in, or even better, tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks, everyone, for being here for my first ride with the Takeaway crew. I'll be in over the next few weeks, along with John Hockenberry and Todd Zwillick. Looking forward to talking more soon. Have a great weekend and happy St. Patrick's Day. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. By Squarespace, a website building platform that helps anyone register a domain and create their own website. More at Squarespace.com. Squarespace. Make your next move. Indeed.com, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where business owners and HR professionals can post job openings, then review candidates, take notes, and schedule interviews from an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com. And Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turned cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.